Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 15th of November. It's all things political, as it always is, Monday at 9 o'clock, and we're pleased to have Julian Zelizer with us again. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's an incredibly prolific writer. We spoke with him last about his new book, Jimmy Carter, It's Part of the American Presidents series, and he's also author of The President's of George W. Bush, A First Historical Assessment, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he is the author or editor of many other books that look at U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions since the New Deal. He appears frequently on radio and television and writes frequently for CNN.com. And many other publications. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Zelizer. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Feel free to use either of those. They're both available to you. And the second hour of our program today, last Thursday was Veterans Day, as you know, and we were trying to schedule our 10 o'clock show with veterans. Unfortunately, there were a number of parades. Well, fortunately for the veterans, this was good, but we were not able to schedule them because it was prime parade time on Thursday. So we will be celebrating Veterans Day a little bit late as far as the official date. And we will speak with two veterans, one a veteran of three wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And we'll also be speaking with a Vietnam vet. So that's coming up, hour number two of our program. Professor Julian Zelizer, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lame duck session starts today. You wrote recently that John Boehner has a huge problem on his hands, that he will have to tame the passions of the GOP freshmen who are coming to town determined to change everything about the way Washington works. What are they determined to change, and what is Boehner's problem in dealing with that?
Well, he faces a similar challenge that Newt Gingrich faced in 1995 when Republicans took over Congress while Clinton was president, and a freshman class came determined to shake up the way Washington works, to literally change the political process, attacking issues like earmarks and even campaign finance reform. And the younger Tea Party Republicans are also calling for pretty drastic, substantial changes in government policy, including huge cuts in spending. So I think John Boehner, Speaker Boehner, will have the challenge of balancing those demands and that passion that the newer members bring with the needs and political interests of the GOP so that they can maintain control in 2012.
He also, it seems to me, has to be working with the administration, and the administration will have to work with John Boehner in order for anything to be accomplished. And yet it's hard to imagine what these two sides are going to be able to accomplish. Otherwise, everybody's going to be really mad.
Well, yes. I mean, it's easy to see how you could have gridlock for the next 2 years because of, you know, divided government and within that a divided Congress. It's very hard to see how many policies will pass. And the irony will be if 2 years later nothing is done and the economy is in about the same shape, a lot of the anger and frustration that led to 2010 will still be there in 2012. That said, it's still hard to see how you overcome that, other than President Obama really giving in to several Republican demands. It doesn't look like the Republicans are going to bend at all.
And indications are, particularly over the weekend with David Axelrod, that this tax breaks for the wealthy is something that the president will give in on, at least for the next couple of years. Is that what you're reading?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually thought that before they lost control of Congress. It's very hard for Democrats to vote for anything that looks like a tax increase, even if it's for wealthier Americans. The party is always skittish about doing that, regardless of what the polls say. You know, going back to 1984, when Walter Mondale, running against Ronald Reagan, said he would raise taxes during the campaign and paid for it. And so now, in the last week, the administration has given several indications they're willing to compromise in extending these taxes, tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. First, Axelrod, in an interview with the Huffington Post, basically said they'll extend them. Obama then said they wouldn't, but they've given indications they will temporarily extend them, which for all intents and purposes, you know, is basically what the Republicans want, because, you know, a few years later, the Democrats will be in the same jam.
Right. I wonder if we must, because we've had the tax breaks for the wealthy for a little while now. Are there any indications that those breaks have been helpful in helping the economy?
No. Tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans generally don't help the economy. There's very little economic evidence that that's the case. There are arguments to be made, and they are made by conservatives that wealth should be retained by the people who make the money. But that's not the kind of stimulative policy that has a big effect. You know, wealthy people don't spend that money, and that's really what you're looking for to kickstart the economy. So there's no evidence in the last few years that's helped at all.
Well, if that's the truth, then why can't the Republicans and Democrats agree that we just can't afford it? We have a huge deficit. Those who have a whole lot can pay a little more.
Well, Republicans will argue that rather than do that, they should start with cutting spending. And what's happened in addition to this debate over the taxes in the last week is this report by a commission on deficit reduction. And they've put forth a package of taxes and also pretty deep spending cuts that they say will be needed to really bring the budget into balance. So each party uses the deficit and uses a moment like this to try to position where public policy will shift. And Republicans are not going to give in on taxes until there are very serious concessions on government spending, particularly for social programs, maybe even Social Security. So it's a kind of game of chicken that the parties have, and the Republicans are not going to give in right at the start of the debate.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I've had a chance, the pleasure, to speak with you since the midterms. What happened?
Well, probably a number of factors. Clearly, the big one, and it's hard to miss every time you go on the polls, is public opinion did turn on President Obama's policies. And clearly, you know, the Republicans capitalized on that to increase their numbers in the House. I do think in the end the Republicans had a better political strategy, which isn't always just a reaction to public opinion, but they mobilized, they shaped the debate, they were able to present President Obama as being left and center, of center, even when many of his policies are not. And they were more effective at that than Democrats were in responding. So they took a midterm that's usually bad and made it extremely bad. And the Tea Party, you know, deserves some credit. They probably, ironically, cost the Senate, the Republicans the Senate. They didn't get it because of some high-profile races where Tea Party candidates couldn't pull it off. But at the same time, they energized a Republican Party that was totally demoralized 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, the economy. I mean, look, if President Obama made a bet early in his presidency, he sent to Congress some extremely controversial bills like health care and financial regulation. The bet was that in 2 years the economy would have been much better, so that all the anger and controversy over those bills was balanced by improved economic numbers. But instead, what you had was all the controversy and fallout over those bills without a good economy, in fact, with a very bad economy. And that's just a recipe for a bad midterm.
We've done a lot of shows, Professor Zelizer, on the economy, and so many people are saying that we don't have a handle on what's going on. We know we've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. We haven't really replaced them. We haven't put a lot of money in clean energy or figured out what to do at this point. What do you think? Does anybody have a plan as to what is going to help us now, or are we just in a let's muddle along period for quite some time to come?
I think we're in a muddle along period. I think there's two parts of the debate. One is, what can you do in the short term to at least alleviate some of the pain many Americans are feeling and to at least jumpstart the economy?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the debate that revolves around the stimulus. Do you need another stimulus? Should the stimulus have been bigger? Should we extend unemployment benefits and how much? But then there's a second debate, which isn't really addressed, kind of what's the cause of this economic downturn beyond all the problems and bad activity in Wall Street. And there's structural changes taking place with jobs going to China and other low-wage areas, certain parts of America's economy kind of lagging behind. And those are the kinds of issues some academics talk about. But it doesn't seem like policymakers in either party are dealing with it. And if they don't, all you're doing is putting Band-Aids on a much longer-term problem. What's needed is policies, both from the market and the government, to really revitalize sectors of our economy so that we're competitive internationally.
Mm-hmm. And what about the president? Is he going to be able to come up with any ideas to get anything through? Tell me about how diminished he is as a result of these elections.
Well, presidents are as diminished as they want to be. Clearly, look, his political standing on Capitol Hill is weakened. Although some people said this is a good thing for Obama, that having divided government, you know, will help him attack Republicans. Yeah. I don't buy that. I mean, I think this is not good. You don't want the other party controlling part of Congress, you know, both because they can cause problems, they can send him controversial bills, they can kill whatever he wants. And at the same time, he can't blame a Republican Congress because it's not. It's a Democratic and Republican Congress. So he's in a weak legislative position. But look, presidents have taken a situation like this and rebounded. The classic examples, Ronald Reagan after 1982, Democrats really do well in the midterms, but Reagan comes back. And in 1984, he has a huge re-election, and he kind of governs from a position of strength even after the midterms. He never compromises on many of his key policies. And Bill Clinton, while we remember him coming back by saying the era of big government is over, he was also successful because he stood firm on certain issues like cuts to Medicare, resisted the cuts Republicans wanted to make. So it is possible to rebound, and he too was reelected. So it really depends what Obama wants to do. So far, he's been playing defense, and I think he's been struggling to find a way to come back.
Well, that's interesting you use this phrase, stand firm. Where has he stood firm? Where do you imagine he will stand firm?
I don't know. I mean, I think many Democrats are wondering right now. He's kind of instantly given ground on the big question for the lame duck Congress, the tax cuts. I think health care will be where he stands firm. Right now, there's going to be a big push to repeal the health care program, but more importantly and more of a threat, to cut the funding, to really also weaken the implementation of the program. Many states are now under the control of Republican governors who are saying, we are not going to, you know, put this into effect. And I think that's where President Obama is going to have to step up, and he's going to have to make sure that program works.
Mm-hmm.
Because if 2 years from now he has all this controversy and a program that's just not working, it's ineffective, that's the worst of everything for him.
Right.
And so I think that's where he's going to really have to kind of draw a line in the sand.
We spend a phenomenal amount of time analyzing that healthcare debate. It just went on for such a long period of time. And as I was observing it, I was observing the political savvy of Nancy Pelosi, who has been vilified by many. But it seems to me as though she was the one who did stand firm, that the president, we didn't know exactly what he was thinking, but she was able to push this through. She was really effective in what she did. Two questions. Is it wise for her to be the minority leader? And I guess the other question is why she has become so vilified when she seems to be a pretty effective legislator.
Well, I mean, on the first part, I think there are reasons to keep her in place. I know that's not the conventional wisdom. But what you're looking for in a legislative leader is not someone who's popular nationally. It's someone who could hold the party together, who could keep the Democrats disciplined, who can keep them on message, and who could be effective when it comes to real legislative battles. She fits all of that, and her clout has not diminished at all in those respects. You know, Mitch McConnell is not the most popular person in America. And my guess is if people knew more about him, his popularity might decrease. But he's an extraordinarily effective Senate minority leader. Democrats have not been able to, you know, gain control of the Senate, basically, because he keeps Republicans in line. So why give away a very effective leader just because of those national polls, when what you really need is someone in the House who's going to be able to cause Speaker Boehner problems, who'll be able to protect key legislative items? And she shows she can do that. She's been remarkably effective and can hold together her party. So I think there's actually good reason to keep her, and it might have been a mistake to put someone less experienced and less effective in that position. Why she's unpopular, I think, you know, Republicans, again, were very effective at making a villain out of her. They made her a face of liberalism. They made her a face of kind of extremism, whether it was true or not, that the American public bought. There might be some gender in there. There's a history of taking powerful women and turning them into this kind of a caricature. But again, that's not what the Democrats should focus on. They can focus on what she does on Capitol Hill.
And what about, getting back to where we started before we start taking calls, what about Boehner? Will he be able to hold his party together and be a strong leader?
We'll see. It's not an easy challenge he faces. Again, you have a large number of voices in the GOP in the House, both Tea Party candidates, but also just the other Republicans who really are coming to Washington ready to shake things up. And when you have a large number of people who want to shake things up, the Speaker has a challenge. He has to make sure he can channel that energy and use it as a constructive force for the Republican Party, something that can undercut President Obama, rather than giving President Obama an opportunity to raise questions about what the Republican Party is. So that's the challenge. And he faces a Senate where Harry Reid is not going to want to do business with him. So we'll see. He's kind of an unknown. He's an inside player. He is as Washington as they come. The irony of the whole thing is this Tea Party Republican Party now has a speaker who's inside as they come in Washington.
Julian Zelizer is our guest for All Things Political, and our phone lines are wide open for you. We're talking about the lame duck session of Congress, which starts today. The big issue, of course, is this tax increase for the wealthy, which the president has indicated that he's willing to let that go, at least for a couple of years. What do you think about that? The big question that we continue to address is what you expect from this, not just lame duck session, of course, but the new session of Congress. What do you expect them to do? What do you want them to take on? Do you have hopes that they will be able to work together? What do you think of the leadership of both parties? What do you think about the Obama presidency? I also want to ask Julian about Afghanistan, which doesn't seem to be going very well. And Hamid Karzai has essentially over the past couple of days asked Americans to back off. Woo! Bit of a mess there, huh? Here's our phone number. Join us. 800, one line open, 486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two, we pay tribute to our veterans. We will speak with a gentleman who is a veteran of World War II, the Korea War, and Vietnam. And we'll also be joined by another vet who is served in the Vietnam War. So that's coming up, hour number two. Let's start our phone calls for Professor Julian Zelizer with Sharon from Duluth. Hi, Sharon.
Oh, hi. When you first started your conversation, you were talking about the tax issue. And I'm from Minnesota, and Mark Dayton pretty much campaigned real strongly on the issue of taxing people that were better able to pay. And now it looks pretty likely that he's going to win. Now, I admit it's been a pretty close race, but I just don't understand why the Democrats can't get across the message the way Mark Dayton did, because I think if it were clear, it just makes so much sense. It must be the problem with how they explain things.
Is that the problem, Professor Zelizer?
I think many Democrats feel that way. And again, public opinion tends to support the Democrats.
Yes, it does.
That's the irony. Mm-hmm. It's not in favor of these tax cuts. I think part of the difficulty is As Democrats have boasted, the Obama passed a very expansive set of domestic bills in his first 2 years. So Republicans are very good at going on television and saying, look, you're doing all this government spending. Why are we going to start with cutting the deficit by raising taxes? And Democrats haven't figured out a way to communicate a different message. And many Democrats, again, are extremely defensive when it comes to taxes. It's kind of the third rail, not Social Security, but tax increases.
I was listening. Sometimes you hear somebody and what they say is so striking, you just remember it. I was listening to 60 Minutes. I've mentioned this before, Julian, about a month ago, and David Stockton was on, the tax guy for Ronald Reagan, who said, and I wonder if you agree with this, that if you put a, he was calling for a surcharge of the upper 15% income earners in this country. If you tax them at 15%, a surcharge for the upper 10% of people, you would cut the deficit by one half.
Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but it does make sense, and it clearly would have a very big impact. And you've had moments in American history where tax increases have been on the table for that very purpose. During World War II, during the late 1960s, the President and Congress raised taxes. In the early 80s, Ronald Reagan, in 1982 and 83, accepted tax increases after having cut taxes too much, and deficits were ballooning. So that's the message, that's the way to sell it. But there will have to be a trade-off at this point. I mean, the political climate and environment is such that Democrats will no longer get those, if they get them at all, without some concessions in government spending and, you know, perhaps on issues like Social Security. So that's the bargain they're going to have to make at this point. I think it's too late to just push for those upper-income taxes at this point.
Well, and it would have to be programs like Social Security, wouldn't it? Because that's where the money is. But nobody wants anybody to really touch their Social Security. It is loved.
Well, that's the problem with the budget. I mean, if you look at the composition of the budget, most of our domestic spending goes to Social Security and Medicare, two extraordinarily popular programs. So if you want to talk about real spending reductions, you know, talking about other social programs won't really get you far. Those are the programs that have to be dealt with. And Republicans, as well as Democrats, know this is not a popular action. No one really wants those programs to be cut when you start talking about it, when you start to spell out what those would be. So it's a real dilemma. You can't increase taxes, and you can't cut most of social spending. So the idea of deficit reduction seems a bit of a fantasy, unless somehow we have new revenue coming into Treasury.
Yeah. Let's go to Patricia in Portage. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I mean, your guest makes it sound like, you know, the Democrats should just compromise. The Republicans aren't going to, so the Democrats should. I mean, in my mind, Obama's lesson is to go to his base, fight for his base, and articulate it well. I mean, the Republicans should be looking like the people that want to cut social programs for the vulnerable while they're protecting, siphoning off even more money to this huge disparity of wealth. It's just outrageous that they're getting away with this and that Obama doesn't see and he wants to give away the store. I don't understand how a smart man doesn't learn his lessons, and I don't like hearing your guests say, well, you know, the Republicans aren't going to compromise. That's a given. So let's just have the Democrats give everything up, that, and they represent the people, or should. And, you know, the Republicans are just the meanies in the bad, bad political spectrum who have, you know, have caused this chaos and then step in like they're going to fix it.
And Obama is a big disappointment to you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I voted for him because he promised that he would stand up for us. And, of course, I'm disappointed that he's not fulfilling his huge promise of creating, you know, I know it's a difficult situation. I know he was handed a can of worms, but the Republicans created it. So I don't understand this attitude.
Professor Zelizer.
I actually don't disagree with your caller that much. I have an article today on CNN just about that. talking about the political strategy of the two parties. And Democrats in general, you know, play defense in politics. They're always hesitant to outline what their ideas are and what their policies are. They're very reluctant to try to strong arm their programs through Congress. And Republicans are just the opposite. I mean, it was remarkable after Republicans lost control of Congress in 2006, they never went on the defensive. They still championed President Bush's policies. They refused to compromise with Democrats. Even after the election of 2008, most Republicans refused to sign on to what Obama was doing and stuck to their agenda of tax cuts and deregulation. Even President Bush, in his new memoir, is, you know, he doesn't apologize for the policies he put into place. He apologizes for certain issues or expresses regrets about the lack of WMDs or the absence of WMDs in Iraq, about the photo op with Katrina, but he doesn't, apologize for his policies. And I think Democrats are in a mode where they're constantly on the defense. They, in fact, read from this midterm the worst message and said it was a mandate for conservatives and they need to compromise. And I agree with the caller, just in looking at the parties, that tends to be a losing strategy. They cede instantly the debate to the Republican Party.
And you can't help, so much was made of the times in which we lived and live and compared Obama's entering the presidency to what FDR faced. Certainly, when you look at that comparison, FDR did not play defense and people didn't like him in huge numbers, but he really held pretty solidly to transforming this country in many ways.
It's absolutely true. I mean, none of the kind of most successful Democratic presidents had it easy. I think we often have a nostalgia that, you know, everything is in such worse shape, or politically everything has shifted so much that it's impossible for Obama to get what he needs done. But that's just not true. FDR faced, like you said, an economy that was in much worse shape. He faced some very fierce opponents in the business community and the press. Lyndon Johnson, the same thing. When he pushed for civil rights in 1964, or voting rights in 65, it wasn't as if, you know, the political system was so receptive to what he was doing. People were literally killing each other in the South over these issues. So what great presidents have to do is, in this adversity, in these difficult moments, find ways to fight for their programs, to sell their programs, and to outflank the opposition.
Right.
And so I think that's the message to take from the past, not that things were so much easier.
And from another political perspective, Ronald Reagan did the same thing.
Absolutely. Again, Reagan, just look at him after those 1982 midterms. You know, he sticks with his theme of anti-communism in foreign policy. He's very clear on what he wants to do. And while making adjustments, he doesn't back down from his overall message. And again, he accepts some small tax increases to reduce the deficit, but he still defends his basic program in 1981, which was a huge slash in taxes, and he pushes for deregulation. He sticks to those principles. He does not read from the midterm a message that he needs to back down or he needs to be cautious. And I think that is the way to go in American politics. We like winners.
Mm-hmm.
We like
fighters.
Stay on the offense.
Yeah. Patricia, thanks. Mike in South Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. First, I have a comment. I just wish Wisconsin public radio listeners would wake up. From my perspective, we have one political party in this country, the Republicrats, the party of the plutocrats. And President Obama is a member of that party, and he stuffed his White House with people like Larry Summers, who are members of that group. So it doesn't make any difference who we elect. With our system now, we have one governing party. Franklin Roosevelt was willing to take on the plutocrats. Now my question: what does the author think about our military situation? I'm reading Andrew Bacevich's book, Washington Rules. And the premise of that book is that it doesn't matter who is the president, that these policies, be they military, be they domestic, just continue unrestrained, and it's going to continue that way unless we have a person like Roosevelt willing to take on the plutocracy, and Obama is not that person.
I mean, that's a good point. It's one that's often made, that unless you change the way that the political system works and you undercut the power of private money or military interests, that basically you're going to have the same set of policies. I think many of Obama's supporters feel this, that the change from 2008 to 2009 was not as great as people hoped for. The White House was filled with economic advisors who were market-oriented Democrats, and the policies in Afghanistan and Iraq have continued. So that is a criticism. It was actually a criticism that was and has still been made about FDR. Many people said that about FDR as well, that he was far from a radical, and that he wanted to save capitalism, not to replace it. But we also have to realize there are differences between the parties. And if you make the argument too much that everything's the same, you leave yourself in a kind of mess politically and unable to distinguish what some of the differences are. There are differences in the economic policies that the two parties pursue. Larry Bartels, a political scientist, has a great book about how democratic economic policy historically does tend to benefit working and middle-class Americans, while Republican policies are supply-side oriented, geared toward wealthier Americans. And so we have to be cognizant that there have been differences, even if the basics, the basic parameters of debate stay the same.
Thanks very much for the call. Email from Alan Bayfield, who wants you to comment on the article in the Washington Post over the weekend by Pat Caddell and Douglas Schoen, recommending that Obama not run in 2012. The thrust was, by not having to immediately focus on a reelection campaign, he could devote himself more fully to addressing the problems we face and remove McConnell's number one priority to make him a one-term president.
Yeah, I read the op-ed. Both recently have been closer to the Republicans than the Democrats, even though Caddell was one of the big Democratic pollsters under Jimmy Carter. I think the argument, you know, is suspicious at best, and I don't think it really makes much sense. I mean, first, why should President Obama concede at this point? I'm not sure that removing yourself from the election so soon strengthens you politically. My guess is Republicans would only become more aggressive if they knew he wasn't running. They'd be more excited that they could win in 2012. They would only raise their demands and insist that Obama follows through. And if Obama isn't running in 2012, why would he accept policies that he fundamentally disagrees with? He loses any political incentive to compromise. So my guess is if you did what Caddell and Schoen are arguing, you'd have more gridlock. You'd end up with a divided Democratic Party, and probably none of the basic issues that the authors are saying need to be addressed would be dealt with. So I'm not sure that is the solution. If the message is he should govern like a one-term president, that's different. That means going for what he thinks is right, pushing for bold policy, but still running.
Yeah, interesting. Mark in Richland Center, hi.
Good morning. Why do we keep talking about the differences between the right and the left when, in fact, we're both parties living under this Federal Reserve private money-issuing society so that our currency is issued by private banks and we keep getting further and further into debt because every dollar that goes into circulation is actually a debt instrument? We don't talk about that, so you could talk about the differences between economic theory, but the theories don't actually address the actual cause of the biggest problem for our indebtedness, which is that our currency is not issued by our government, but by private banks.
Well, you have more talk about the Federal Reserve and currency in recent weeks than I've heard in a long time, which is kind of interesting. Again, there are people, different parts of the political spectrum, who argue that unless you get to the underlying ways in which our economy and political system works, you can't address many of the issues we face. But again, I think we're not going to get rid of the Federal Reserve. We're not going to get rid of the way our currency works right now. And there's still a lot of room for debate and differences over policies within the system that we operate in.
Let's go to Afghanistan for a moment before we go back to phone calls. Karzai saying over the weekend, essentially telling Americans to back off, that he'll deal with the Taliban, which will have to be a part of the government. This has not gone well for 9 years, and it continues to not go well. And now you got this guy who we propped up saying, get out.
Yes, I mean, that's what happens in bad wars. You're always kind of running into, you know, a new setback. You're dealing with an unstable government, a corrupt government, and one that's not clearly working with the United States. The interests aren't always the same. And I think, you know, at best, what Obama's surge can bring, like Bush's surge in Iraq, is some kind of stability, fragile stability, but not a good outcome in the war. It's hard to see how you can deal with the existing government there and have a country that's going to be, you know, working in tandem with the United States. And I don't think Obama has solved those problems. I mean, he brought in a troop surge, again, to stabilize conditions on the ground, but not to address the underlying political problems we face with the country.
We go to John in Burlington. Hi.
Hi. This recent election has just reinforced what happens, it seems, every time, where the Republicans, it becomes all about vocabulary and you know, the two words that, you know, they use very differently or take advantage of would be patriotism and entitlements. Entitlements, to me, that has that kind of negative connotation, like something for nothing, you know, and rather than set the Republicans straight on that, the Democrats just kind of let them have that word and make it be a bad thing, you know. And then as far as patriotism go, you know, the Republicans use that to death, except isn't it patriotic if you're really a rich person in this country that, you know, you're getting rich in, that you should pay some taxes? It just seems that that's my frustration, is I always I watch this and go, okay, here we go again, that we're losing the election based on these buzzwords that really are, you know, people just kind of let it become about that.
I mean, I tend to think buzzwords, perception, all that does matter in elections and campaigns, and we have to take it seriously, and Republicans have been able to frame the debate much more effectively than Democrats, and they've been able to paint their opponents more effectively than Democrats paint Republicans. You know, when the Tea Party emerged, there was many people writing about extremism in the Tea Party and talking about some of the racial arguments you would see at Tea Party rallies. But the Tea Party and Republicans were able to overcome that pretty quickly, and they kind of kept their image in a successful light. But at the same time, we can't ignore policy. Look, the economy is still not good, and at some level, it's a response to the policies that drove many voters against Obama. It was not as bad as it could have been, but that's not a great argument for your public policies. When unemployment's 9.5%, you're going to come under criticism. The health care bill was controversial, and many people in the Democratic and Republican Party were not satisfied with what came out of that process. There's questions. Will it work? Will it really cut our premiums? Will it bring down health care costs? And so while perception matters, we do also have to look at the real policy debates that people in this country are having.
Well, let's talk about that unemployment rate for a while, because somebody has to do something about that, I think. Just for people need jobs. People need to have a purpose in their lives. People need, and work gives them meaning in many ways. How in the world are the Democrats and the Republicans going to deal with this issue, which the American public is really demanding that they deal with? They need work.
No, look, that's basically the concern that drove this election. They need work. Where are the jobs, and what are you going to do about it?
Right, yeah.
But the problem is the political system right now and the configuration of Congress and the White House is not set up to deal with the problems. It's set up to have ongoing political competition right now and gridlock. So I don't have an answer of how a system like that is going to be able to deal in comprehensive fashion with the factors that are causing these unemployment rates, or to produce a kind of stimulus that would actually bring the numbers down. There's a disconnect between our political system and the economic problems this nation faces.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest, and thank you very much for your call, John. He is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, the author of so many books, I can't tell you all, but most recently, Jimmy Carter, published by Times Books, and editor of a book assessing former President George W. Bush's administration that was published by Princeton University Press. Here's our phone number. One line is open right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What was it like for a person to serve in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War? One of our veterans served in all of those wars. The other veterans served in the Vietnam War. We'll pay tribute to veterans, hear about their war experiences, their peacetime experiences, coming up the second hour of our program today. Professor Julian Zelizer is with us now. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's go to another email, this one from Barb in Ashland. If the Republicans want to focus on cutting big government, why don't they focus on government? Cut 20% across the board on the executive branch, legislative, and judicial at the federal, state, and local level. There is so much waste in the administration of our government. How about that as a solution?
Yeah, that's usually what many politicians focus on. It's easier to cut administrative and bureaucratic waste than actually going after, public spending and government programs. A, it's difficult, and B, in the end, what you can get from that won't really bring down the spending and the deficits. You have to, if you want to go this path, go after big spending, not just domestic programs, military programs. And the problem is, when you do that, many members of Congress in both parties get unhappy because constituents want the programs government brings. Americans are always philosophically conservative. They're against government in general. They're against the principle of government over markets, but they are operationally liberal, meaning when you talk about specific programs, they want them, whether defense or Social Security. So the administrative path is interesting. It's good, but I don't think it will solve the problem that the country faces.
Tom in Green Bay.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
One of my things that I haven't seen on the table regarding the taxes is capital gains. Short-term capital gains, especially if I remember right, they're taxed only at 15%. Why aren't they if they would tax them at the same rate as a person's income, I think they could recoup some money for the deficit regarding that.
They probably could. I'm not a tax expert, and I don't know kind of where they are or what you can recoup at this point. But again, I think that faces the same political challenges as taxes for individuals on their income. It's just very easy to frame that, if you're a Republican, as being harmful for the economy. To increase taxes on capital gains when the economy is still lagging is not an easy argument to make for Democrats. And I just think every indication we have had right now is moving away from the administration, pushing not only for, ending the tax cuts for the wealthy that Bush put into place, but certainly avoiding any other kind of tax increase at this time. I just think it's off the table politically.
Thanks, Tom. Fred in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi. Just wanted to comment on capital gains. For short-term gains, it is 35% right now. The only thing that was reduced was the long-term gains that you hold stock for over a year. So it is 35% for short-term. Question I had is, I always wonder how much of this $4 trillion debt was G.W. Bush's and how much of it was Obama. Bush was the one that issued the IOUs to China for the Iraq War. He claims that he was involved with the stimulus bill in the beginning, the bank bailout, the loans to the auto companies. And then Obama has to come in and spend money to clean up part of what he's done. And then I see where this panel that's been studying what to do on the debt comes out and recommends eliminating the mortgage deduction from your income tax, which basically would do away with the long form, raising the Social Security age, a 15-cent per gallon increase in gas tax, and raising the capital gains taxes. These are all raises in taxes. I just get confused when, you know, it's just another way of raising taxes. Well, that's my comment.
Yeah, I mean, on the deficit, it's a very, I think it's clear that a lot of the current deficit results from policies put into place before Obama ever came to town. Whether it's the, let's not also forget the tax cuts of 2001 and 2003, the spending on both of the wars, the TARP program, which is not an invention of President Obama, it's an invention of President Bush, all those added up. And don't forget Medicare prescription drugs and many other just congressional spending that the Republicans approved. This was an era where Republicans spent a lot of money and they cut a lot of taxes, and they, you know, fueled an era of deficits. And the health care plan is not something that's going to increase the deficit. If it works, it reduces the deficit. So what you're talking about is the stimulus versus a whole term of policies that really significantly raised the deficits of this federal government. And again, it's hard to make that argument to voters today, but I think the historical record is very clear.
But there certainly is a difference between the historical record and what's happening, because we said when he was elected that, you know, give him a certain amount of time in office, and I think that time is past, and they're his problems now.
No, absolutely. You know, once you're in office for 2 years, you've gone through your first midterm. Even if the person before makes a mess or causes problems, it's your responsibility then to fix. That's the purpose of the election. That's the argument that President Obama made. So 2 years into it, that kind of it was Bush's fault argument, I just don't think, A, it holds politically, it doesn't hold together, but it also might not be a kind of legitimate argument at this point, meaning that's what he's in office for.
Yeah.
So the question isn't who caused it, but who's going to fix it. And he's the one who now has the responsibility for doing that.
And it's self-serving, except it's not entirely self-serving, because I really believe in public radio and television in this country, but that commission also called for cutting government funding for public radio and television in this country. Can you do you imagine that's going to become a big debate?
Yes, I think it will. I mean, I think public radio, you know, again, in terms of the budget, it's not the kind of item that would have a big effect.
Yeah, it's minuscule.
Effect. So it's a symbolic issue. Mm. But it's something that a lot of Americans do listen to and feel attached to. Going back to 95, when Republicans started to push for cuts, when the cuts became visible, and they were things that are very real to Americans, whether it's what you listen to or whether it's the zoos you go to in Washington, then there's a backlash against it. You know, people are not easy when it comes to cutting their government. And so I'm not sure those are the kinds of things that will work. And it won't have the effect anyway that they're looking for.
Bill in Wild Rose, hi.
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 The question I have for your guest is, I have a hard time knowing why the average American supports the Republican Party today, when, in fact, a lot of the benefits that they've had from the Democrats, such as Social Security, workman's comp, sick leave, paid holiday, if those programs were up for a vote today, the Republicans would be dead set against them. And yet, these people support the Republicans in the last election. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of what the Tea Party built their energy on was a very real anger and frustration with the economy that we've discussed. And they were talking about, you know, middle-class Americans, not wealthy Americans. But the record is clear that Republican policies don't tend to benefit this level of wage earner. But, you know, Republicans still have managed, by looking at other issues like national security or through their attacks and the way they paint Democrats, they've been able to pick up votes sometimes with these voters and win the support of people whose interests might actually be better served through the Democratic Party. That's how politics works. That's why these issues of perception and argument are important when it comes to Election Day.
Thanks for the call. We go to Patricia. We have a minute left. Hi, Patricia.
Yes, I'll make this quick. I can't see. We talk about the banks and the money that's out there that they're holding on to instead of investing it in small business and creating jobs. And I see there's no real interest, vested interest in this level of economy to help the economy look better, because that will only make Obama look better and make it, if he really does resolve this economic problem, he will be reelected and the Democrats will get the credit. So the banks, I see, are hanging on to the money instead of investing it in small business or job creation. They have no interest in doing that.
It's hard to game how a better economy will work. You know, it can also help Republicans, meaning they were elected, the economy rebounded. That's what a Republican can do for you. So I'm not always sure that's how they're making their calculation. Look, I think a better economy would actually help both parties. I don't think either party likes this kind of unrest in the electorate because it can cut both ways. It makes voting hard to predict. In the end, there's moments when politicians do deal with our problems, and even in the worst of political times. And I think what much of the country is hoping for, that, you know, they're going to surprise us in the next couple of years.
Thank you, Professor Zelizer. You're a great guest.
Thank you.
Thanks. Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. His two latest books, one on Jimmy Carter and one on George W. Bush. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios, and thank you, everybody, for all of your intelligent calls. News is coming up, and we'll return here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.